Pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning
with the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On this week's program, I will be reading excerpts from Stories in Stone, Memories from a Bygone Farming Community in North Carolina, an oral history of the William B. Umstead State Park area by Tom Weber. Chapter 1, The Land and the People. Native Americans were the first visitors to the area that is now William B. Umstead State Park. However, according to historian Dolores Hall in her manuscript, by the time of European settlement in the North Carolina Piedmont, few, if any, Native Americans remained. As early as the late 17th century, only small groups of such tribes as the Eno, Shikori, and Okanichi were left after exposure to European diseases. Remnants of these groups banded together and moved to refuge areas elsewhere. It is doubtful if any evidence of protohistoric Native American sites exists within the park. However, the 1938 Park Master Plan report says that arrowheads have been found within the park borders. In Indian days, bobcats, bear, mountain lions, red wolves, skunks, passenger pigeons, and ivory-billed woodpeckers roamed this region, writes North Carolina State University ecologist Arthur Cooper. Bison entered between 1000 and 1600 A.D. NC Archives and history researcher Michael Hill writes, "The first permanent settlers moved into the park area about 1800. A second and larger influx took place during the 1850s. What Cary historian Tom Bird writes below of that town also applies to the nearby W.B. Umstead State Park area. Early landowners were primarily of British descent, Bird notes. Upon their arrival, they found a magnificent forest dominated by oaks. The uplands also had hickories and a few pines. Most of the pines seen today came in after the original forest was destroyed. Tulip poplar and beech were the native trees on moist, well-drained soils. Sycamore, sweet gum, river birch, and willow oaks lined the creeks. The forest largely sustained the earliest settlers, providing shelter, food, and fuel. Wild turkeys, white-tailed deer, and squirrels were dietary staples. Another valuable animal was the beaver. Settlers earned their living from the soil, forest, or waterways.
In the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lane with your baby mine. You hold her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very...
Aspects of what historian Elizabeth Reed Murray writes about Wake County area farmers of 1750 also fit the first land grant holders in the park area 20 or 30 years later. First-hand accounts of everyday life in Wake County's earliest settlement years are virtually non-existent. No private records in the form of diaries or letters have come to light to give word pictures of life at mid-18th century. Many people could neither read nor write, and even those who could were far too busy clearing land, creating shelters for their families and stock against elements and animals, and wrestling food from the new, unproven soil to think of turning into recorded history the very real history they were making. Any word pictures, therefore, of early Wake homes and their furnishings, marriages and births, illnesses and funerals, children's education, entertainment, social and religious activities, must be pieced together from bits and scraps recorded in the few documents that have survived, and from family stories handed down through generations to present-day descendants. 1960s graduate student William Willis's notebooks contain a map showing the 34 earliest, mostly post-colonial, land grants for properties in the W.B. Umstead State Park area. Willis apparently got the information from A.B. Markham, who in 1973 copyrighted his map called Land Grants to Early Settlers in Present Wake County, period 1739 to 1830. The first grant in Willis's notebook, for William Warren, is notable because we have a genealogy of Warren's family covering parts of each generation from 1779, when Warren received his grant, to the 1930s, when the federal government bought the property to build the park. The Warren grant is listed below. 1. William Warren, grant number 727, 1779. 170 acres on south side of Sycamore Creek, joining John Purdom, James Pye, Ralph Hollifield, and his own. Begin at a pine on Purdom's corner, in Warren's line runs 200 poles to a pine, Pye's corner, then west 135 poles to a hickory in Hollifield's line. Then, with said line north 200 poles to a small red oak, and then to the beginning. Other early landowners were the Blakes, Pages, and Dillards. Descendants of these early park area residents are represented in the oral histories that follow. Several creeks cut through the landscape, in places flowing through steep ravines. Sycamore Creek meandered northwest to southeast before meeting Crabtree Creek, which flowed west to east. Reedy Creek flowed north to meet Crabtree Creek. There were no natural lakes in the area. Along the creeks, water-powered mills were built during the 19th century. Page's Mill, later called the Company Mill, was built on Crabtree Creek about 1810. The George Lynn Mill was built by 1871 on Sycamore Creek, and another mill apparently existed on Sycamore Creek below where the Big Lake Dam is now. Other mills included one on Reedy Creek and Cook's Mill on Richland Creek. Farming life progressed rather uneventfully until the outbreak of the Civil War. Men from park area families may have joined two Confederate military groups based in Cedar Fork District, which likely included the western side of the community that this book documents. Wake County historian Elizabeth Reed Murray states that, until surveyor Fendall Bevers made his Wake County Township map in 1871, the county was divided into captains' districts, many of which had indefinite boundaries. Bevers' Cedar Fork Township map includes such pre-park community landmarks as the Company Mill Pond on Crabtree Creek, the O. Page home site, and Adams Crossroads. Elizabeth Reed Murray quotes a Virginia visitor to Wake County who noticed martial enthusiasm on the brink of North Carolina's secession. There was, said the visitor, a good deal of the pomp and circumstance of glorious war, and almost everyone seemed eager to enter upon the stern realities without dreaming what they would be. The Wake regulars, primarily from Wake's Cedar Fork District, writes Murray, and the North Carolina Grays, were formed by eager young men before the secession. The NC Grays were also known as the Morrisville Grays and as the Cedar Fork Rifles. This volunteer unit was composed primarily of western Wake County men and a few neighbors from Chatham County. At least 15 of the volunteers were students from Cedar Fork Academy. Murray noted in 1983 that the Morrisville plant of Northern Telecom at 12587 Mount Hermon Church Road, occupied the approximate site of Cedar Fork Academy, where the Morrisville Grays trained. Murray also noted, the school's principal, Richard Watts York, had suspended classes in order to form and train the light infantry unit, and was its captain. On June 1, 1861, the people of Cedar Fork District staged an all-day farewell party for the Cedar Fork Rifles. A woman presented the troops with a flag the young ladies had made. To the Morrisville Grays by the Ladies of Cedar Fork was inscribed in a corner of the blue silk banner. After prayers, one of the officers who responded to the hosts was Lieutenant Malchus Williamson Page, brother to Oscar Page, whose grave is near the O. Page home site. Malchus was later promoted to captain. After the war, he served first as state representative, then as Wake County Sheriff. Murray also writes that the Morrisville Grays became part of the North Carolina 6th Regiment, later named the Bloody 6th. They participated in the First Battle of Manassas, or Bull Run. During the war, 63 of 209 men in the unit died, and 59 were wounded. The Wake Regulars joined the 7th Regiment, North Carolina Troops, whose distinguished battle flag lists 16 engagements. Before the Great Depression, the rocky, sloping land of what would become William B. Umstead State Park was covered with farmhouses, vegetable gardens, pastures, fields in cotton, wheat, and corn, and abandoned plots in various stages of old field succession. In 1938, 75% of the land was forest. Many of the farmhouses were located along roadways still evident in the park. Two roads, Switchback Road and Old Middle Hillsboro Road, the section of the latter in the park is now called Reedy Creek Trail, met at Adams Crossroads, where Raleigh-Durham Airport is today. Switchback Road crossed the northern part of the area, stretching from near two eastern landmarks, Ebenezer Church, founded in 1883, and Ebenezer School, west to Adams Crossroads, where Sorrell's General Store was in the 1920s and 1930s. Near the store were Mount Hermon Church, founded in 1856, and Mount Hermon School. Ebenezer Church and Adams Crossroads are the east-west landmarks of the Stories in Stone community, although several speakers in this book lived beyond these landmarks. The eastern side of the park was known as Ebenezer Community. The easternmost section of what was Switchback Road is now called Albright Road. This modern hard surface section extends from near Ebenezer Church west to the park border, where the paving ends. The overgrown continuation of Switchback Road is still discernible in the park. What is now called Grayland Trail led south from near Ebenezer Church, crossed Sycamore Creek, and intersected with Old Middle Hillsboro Road, now called Reedy Creek Trail. At this intersection, there were general stores owned first by the Dampiers and then by the Dickinsons in the 1930s. Two roads led to the company mill on Crabtree Creek, one from the south and one from the north. The southern road followed the current I-40 entrance park road to the Rangers' residences, veering left at the first Ranger house, continuing downhill and wrapping sharply to the right just south of Crabtree Creek. The road then paralleled the creek for about 100 yards downstream, ending at an abutment to a wooden bridge. The bridge washed out in the 1930s. The section of road paralleling the creek is still distinguishable. The Old Mill Road on the northern side of Crabtree Creek ran south from Old Middle Hillsboro Road. The remnants of this road emerged just above the Company Mill Trail a few yards east of the Company Mill Monument. Farmers rode their wagons along these rough, unpaved tracks to the mill. The dozens of pile rocks throughout the park suggest that farming the stony landscape was hard work. Chunks of rock scattered over the ground were collected in heaps, now covered with leaf litter. Wake County architectural historian Kelly Lally writes that in the 1920s, rural sociologist W.A. Anderson found part of the area that is now W.B. Umstead State Park to have the least productive cropland in the country. "The farm we lived on was covered with rocks," says Edith Dickinson Highsmith, born in 1913, who moved into the park area with her family in 1919 when she was six. "My father built a sled for hauling rocks, like a tobacco sled, that could be pulled by a mule. Our job, when we came home from school, was to pick up stones off that farm. We throwed them down in a gully, and almost filled that gully up." Wallace King, born in 1923, whose grandfather William Al King, born in 1829, settled in the area in the 19th century, says, "You couldn't raise no tobacco down there," in the eastern part of the park area. "It was mostly cotton and corn. You see, down there it was red clay and rock. Up there, toward what's now Raleigh-Durham RDU Airport, it was a dark type of soil, and it wasn't rocky like it was down there." Mr. Will Dillard, born in 1865, over on the Page Place, he raised tobacco. That was right close to Sycamore Creek, going into the airport there. But over around Ebenezer Church, all through in there, the company mill and all, wasn't nothing in the world but hilly, rocky land. These were the same steep slopes that had discouraged permanent settlements by prehistoric Native Americans who visited the area. As mentioned previously, early landowners in the park area included the Warrens, Pages, Blakes, and Dillards. Some of these families lived on the same land for generations. Lovers of W.B. Umstead State Park are fortunate that, in the 1970s, noted writer Clyde Edgerton, a Warren descendant, researched the history of his ancestors. Because of the material Edgerton collected, some on paper and some on cassette tape, from his mother Truma, born in 1904, Uncle Robert, born in 1896, and Aunts Lila, 1908, Margaret Chloe, 1893, and La Uma, 1899, we have information on one family's life in the area from just after the American Revolution to about 1930. Edgerton used the ancestral Warren family home site and graveyard as models for settings in his novel, The Floatplane Notebooks. In fact, the wisteria vine that has engulfed the Warren home site is one of the characters in the book. The vine tells stories about past generations of a country family. Some of the tales are based on Warren family lore. Every May, the Warrens and their former neighbors, the Haleys, gather to clean the graves and tell the old family stories. William Warren, who died around 1816, was apparently the first member of his family to settle in the area. He left behind 12 children and a large tract of land between Sycamore and Crabtree Creeks after he died. Clyde Edgerton's research into the 1790 U.S. Census of Wake County, North Carolina, shows that William Warren owned 3 slaves. In 1857, William Warren's son Ridley bequeathed these items to a daughter. A cart and 2 oxen, 3 head of cattle, 1 sorrel mare, and 6 hogs, 3 beds and furniture, 2 walnut tables, 2 pine tables, a clock, sideboard, desk and settee, a set of chairs, a clothes press, cupboard, and a loom, a set of water vessels, 3 pots and a frying pan, an oven, 12 plates, 3 dishes, and a set of china, 3 bread trays and 1 grindstone, and all the other household and kitchen furniture now on the place at which I live belonging to me. Ridley's son William Pinckney Warren, born in 1822 and died in 1908, lived in a home on Old Middle Hillsboro Road, now known as Reedy Creek Trail. One day, William Pinckney's hired man Stanley was found dead in a field where he had collapsed. Stanley was buried near the Warren home, the first person interred in what became the Warren Haley Family Cemetery. In The Floatplane Notebooks, Stanley's spirit sings lullabies as he rocks the ghost cradles of unquiet babies buried near him. In fact, the Warren Cemetery has a little stone marked Born Dead, that's spelled D-E-D. Clyde Edgerton uses this poignant image in his book. You've got a walk, you got a walk down a lonesome valley, lonesome valley. You gotta go, you gotta go there by yourself. By yourself. There's no one here. There's no one here. Edgerton's mother, Truma Warren Edgerton, remembers, "My granddaddy and my grandma, William Pinckney Warren and Elizabeth Keith Warren, born 1829, died in 1918, lived in the home by the family graveyard. Elizabeth Keith birthed every one of us, every one of Mama's children. Somebody'd come for her, and she'd get on that horse or mule side saddle and go birth a baby, and name it, too." Truma's sister, Lila Warren Spain, recalls her grandmother. "Elizabeth Keith was the neighborhood doctor and midwife," she says. "Her name was Julia Ann Darby Barbara Farabee Elizabeth Frances Carolina Jane Keith Warren, honest, and her husband called her Puss. She would go out any time, day or night, rode horseback and carried a black bag." Another sister, La Uma, adds, "Once a baby was born with 2 extra little fingers like matchsticks. Elizabeth Keith amputated the fingers and put them behind the clock on the mantel in a bottle of alcohol. We would get them down and pass them around." Tom Bird writes that on Saturday, April 15, 1865, the Union Army's 15th Corps, under the command of Major General John A. Logan, reached Morrisville by a road through what is now W.B. Umstead State Park. Warren family lore has it that foraging Union troops found some hams that Elizabeth Keith Warren had buried on her property. The soldiers were cooking the hams when Elizabeth ran out of the house screaming, "I wish those hams were red hot and in your belly, and you were in the middle of hell," and threw a pot of boiling water on a Yankee. After William Pinckney died in 1908, his son William Alfred Lee, born in 1867, and Alfred's wife Nora, born in 1882, occupied the home place. Alfred's brother Israel, Izzy, born in 1865 and died in 1911, married Henrietta Cope, 1872 to 1939, and had 8 children, including Truma, Lila, Laoma, Chloe, and Robert. Izzy's family lived in the old Page home near the Page Cemetery. Truma Warren Edgerton and her sister Lila Warren Spain remember that in 1911, their father Izzy and brother Luther, Sr., 1890 to 1911, died within 6 weeks of each other in a typhoid epidemic. The community rallied to plow the Warrens' fields after those deaths, but Henrietta could not maintain the farm without her lost men. She had a brief, unsuccessful marriage to a neighbor, Adonijah Baker, 1850 to 1931, then moved to Durham about 1914, where the family got jobs in the mills. Truma recalls, "My daddy's death left my mother with 2 boys and 4 daughters, me and Chloe and Oma and Lila. Naturally, we had hard times, because it was in planting time when these 2 deaths happened, so we hardly knew what we could do. We were living on rented land, which all belonged to the Pages. Well, that's the way it was in the country." Truma's brother Robert says, "Well, I don't know. I guess we'd done all right, considering how we had to live in those days. When a family gets split up, like ours did, and a man died in the full farming time, those people come in from Morrisville and Cary and all around Sorrell's store and all around the graveyard place. They came in and plowed that whole farm in one day." "My brothers Clem and Robert got jobs in Durham," says Truma. "Everybody was looking for a job. In Durham was a better chance than in Raleigh because there were so many factories. American Tobacco Company, Durham Hosiery Mill, Golden Bell Manufacturing Company. So Durham was just full of work for people. So we were still living in the Page House when my daddy died, but my brothers had gone to Durham and gotten jobs. Soon after Daddy died, Mama married Mr. Adonijah Baker because we were all good friends. He had some nice children. Their baby child, Myrtle, stayed with us all she could and claimed us as her family and was just like one of us. But all did not go well with the new arrangement. Robert Warren tells of sitting at the Baker's dinner table. When Adonijah kissed Robert's mother, Henrietta, Robert says, "I just couldn't stand it." Adonijah caught wind of the teenager's hostility and barred him from the house. Robert says that he knocked on the front door and Adonijah wouldn't let him in, so he had to enter through a window. Truma says, "Around 1914, we were living in Durham because my mother decided it was not satisfactory living with the Bakers because he didn't want our brothers to come there. When I was about 12, I went with a friend who was working in a hosiery mill and learned the work. I got $1 a week to learn. I went until the law came that children under 12 couldn't work. The first check I got was for $2.04 for 1 week." Other farm children from the Park area adapted to factory labor early in this century. Ronelda Smith Early, born in 1914, says, "I don't believe I was but 12 when we moved to Durham. I went to work at the cigarette factory before I was 14. You were supposed to be 14. I told the manager I was 14, and he didn't question it, and he put me to work."
Let's take an old-fashioned walk.
Let's have an old-fashioned talk.
We will walk any place you choose to.
Chapter 2. Rural Customs, Arts, and Trades. The place an Umstead Park area resident called home early in the 1900s was likely to be a one-story, 3- or 4-bedroom unpainted house made of rough lumber. The building in most cases sat on brick or stone pillars rather than a full foundation. The roof consisted of tin sheets or handmade wood shingles. The house typically had a sitting room containing a fireplace and a bed, 1 or 2 other bedrooms, and a kitchen. Sometimes the kitchen, outfitted with a wood stove, had only one wall attached to the main house, so the building took on an L shape. In other cases, the kitchen was in a separate building. Illustrations and photos in this book show simple furnishings including a wood stove, gas lamps, a chest, and homemade quilts. Back then, they didn't have closets and things to put your clothes in, says Rebecca King Simpson, born 1919. Clothes were stored in a chest. After sunset on chilly nights, the family climbed under layers of heavy quilts, two or three children to a bed. We only heated with fireplaces, Rebecca says, and we would take something small, a baby blanket or something Mama had there, and warm it real warm in front of the fire, and then race back to the bedroom and wrap it around our feet and stick them under the covers. The sheets felt like ice. We didn't have heated bedrooms, but we were a lot more healthy then than they are today. During the night, there might be a glow from the fireplace or stove, but if someone needed light to see, a gas lamp or a candle was lit, since there was no electricity. Drinking water was poured from a pitcher, as there was no plumbing. We had kerosene lamps, an Aladdin lamp with a mantle for us to do homework, recalls Wiley G. Haley, born in 1930. We didn't burn them much. Our mother had the beds made, and when it got dark, we went to bed early. We would go into the room in the dark without a lamp and crawl under the covers. I can remember very well going with my mother to the Pennington place to get white dirt or clay, a community woman recalls. It was in a little stream in the bank of the creek. You'd get that dirt out and put it in a bucket and take it home and mix some of it with water and whitewash the fireplaces on Saturday night for it to be pretty on Sundays. Women created brooms out of broom sedge, a grass with rigid stems a yard or so long, says Agatha King Johnson, born in 1914. A handful of broom sedge would be wound from one end to the halfway point with string and tied to form the broom. A new broom was used to sweep house floors. The fireplace was cleaned with a worn, blunted broom. Families pulled up the weeds and grass from their yards and swept the dirt smooth. My father was a farmer, says Una Smith Moret, born 1920. He grew cotton and vegetables, and we had cows and chickens and hogs. And at one time we had geese, all kinds of fruit trees, peaches, apples, pears. It was a 40 or 50 acre farm there. It was rocky. I remember he had a spring box down in the pasture where he put the milk in, and they would churn it and take buttermilk and butter to town. We children worked on the farm. We'd get out, use a hoe, get the weeds out of it, and gather vegetables. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.